Microwave links and broadcasting have certainly been around for a while, but for about the past 15 years, our guest, Jeff Holdenrid, has been helping broadcasters get reliable IP microwave links. And that's what we're talking about here. Everything from the inexpensive stuff up to the really expensive stuff, licensed and unlicensed. Where do you need each one? Jeff will be here to tell me and Chris about this. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Lavvo and the Crystal Clear Virtual Radio Console. Crystal Clear is the console with a multi-touch touchscreen interface. And by Direct Current Broadcast e-newsletter. Get Direct Current in your inbox every Thursday with technical pointers putting you and your facility at an advantage. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. Delighted to be here. It's 2017. We start the year with what's going to be a fantastic show. I'm looking forward to it. This is the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower and all the stuff in between, and that's a lot. We're going to be talking about something today that is close to the light on the top of the tower. Not quite there, but it's on the way. On your way up the tower. It's IP radios and our guest, Jeff Holdenrid. He'll be here in just a minute, but first let's bring in our co-host from another interesting location in the New York City area, I suppose, Chris Tobin. Chris, welcome in. Is Chris muted? Maybe he is. It's all right.
That's interesting. Mouse move.
There you go.
Anyway, well, how about that? Yes, you are correct. I am in New York City. It's a transmitter facility. It's one of the buildings here in town, and above me are many of those IP radio devices linking many ISPs and various other agencies back and forth throughout the five boroughs. So, yeah, it's a good location. A little noisy in here, so you're going to hear me turning on and off the microphone as I go through the show.
Is there, Chris, well, first of all, Happy New Year. Glad you're here in 2017. When did we start this show? Was it, back on that other network years ago?
Oh,
was it like 6 years ago?
It was like in October or something, like a month of October.
But was it like 2010?
6 years. Yeah, 6 years. This will be the sixth year. October of this year will be six. Yes, yes.
I guess I could get on the website, thisweekinradiotech.com, and go have a look and see when we started this thing. But yeah, it was in October because after just a few episodes, I did a little Christmas ditty, and then we moved on from there. So, and then we moved to the GFQ network, I guess, what, about 4 years ago?
Yep. Just there's a couple of broadcasters next door doing some work on their transmitter room. And they popped by and saw that I set up. They said, oh, you're getting ready for the podcast. I said, yep. So there's two viewers who are on their way home now and probably watching on their phones as we speak.
We get an amazing number of people I don't even know and would love to meet someday. We have a lot of viewers on the show. More and more, I'm asking people to be a guest and say, hey, if you're not familiar with the show, go to the website, have a look. And they write back and they say, oh, no, I watch the show every week. So isn't that great?
Excellent. Well, I'm good. I'm glad that people are enjoying it and getting something out of it. At least I've been to several conferences up in Canada, and folks have told me they enjoy it a lot for the humorous things we come up with for the various technologies. So I guess I'll have to keep this year. It will be a year of staying on location. I'm not going to do it from home anymore. Home will be wherever I land.
It's always interesting where you are. But is there anything else you can clue us in about where you are? I see some Omnia equipment there.
Okay. Yeah, there's Omnia 6EXI. There's a couple of Burke unit. There's a two Nautel transmitters behind me. Automat RDS. Yeah, there's a few things that's going on, and the Day Sequera mod monitors. Yeah, it's a standard broadcast facility here Times Square.
A 10 kilowatt transmitter would be the right size for most of the stations on Empire State Building. So that's at least in the realm of possibility. But, you know, maybe you can't say exactly where you are.
Oh, well, I can see the Empire State Building from the rooftop. No, I'm not.
Okay.
Today is not Empire. Today it's at Times Square.
Oh, okay. Okay. Now, are you at a backup or a full-time site?
This is a backup site. Can't say what else more, too. But, it's good stuff.
Now, and, giving me a clue, like you can see the Empire State Building from the roof, that's not a clue. You can see it from lots of buildings.
Well, yeah, but from this rooftop, you're sort of eye to eye. I can wave at the people on the observation deck.
True.
A couple of weeks ago, I was on top of the Citicorp building working on a microwave link, and I was watching a helicopter go by, and it turned to be a police helicopter. They sort of stopped and hovered, and the two guys I'm working with, we look at each other going, are we about to have a raid on this rooftop? Because this is not a good sign. Because, you know, when you're in Midtown Manhattan, it's pretty much restricted airspace, so the only aircraft that usually fly by our law enforcement and maybe, just maybe, a news helicopter. But yeah, it was pretty fun. But yes, from here I can see it. I can see a lot of rooftops from here. That's true. But today it's four Times Square. It's a smack in the middle of the crossroads of the world.
It sure is. Sure is. Wow. Hey, so anyway, good to see you back here at 2017. We'll try to see if we can get 50 shows in this year. I think we got about 48, 47 in last year. So our first show, we're going to bring in our first guest, and that is a gentleman named Jeff Holdenred. Jeff, welcome in. Glad you're here.
Thank you for having me, Kirk. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. And you've got a really interesting camera angle. Well, first of all, you work for this company called Double Radius. Interesting name.
Yes, sir.
And I see you guys everywhere at all the trade shows and the state conventions and stuff. And you guys are out there really helping broadcasters. Okay, first of all, tell me real quickly, the elevator speech, who's Double Radius?
Well, I mean, we basically just do IP microwave, which over the last few years broadcasters have been using for STLs. And we've been doing IP microwave since 2001, myself since 1999. So we like to see ourselves as kind of like the go-to pros for IP microwave. We've been educating broadcasters for the last 4 or 5 years now, and there's been a lot of great changes, and we're really excited about where it is today and where it's going to go.
Awesome. And since you've been doing this since 1999, you've got a ton of experience. As we talked off air a few hours ago, you know, I've got a little bit of experience with some very inexpensive gear I was able to make work, but I'm not entirely convinced of the long-term reliability and things I ought to look out for. And you're going to give us this great overview of the inexpensive gear, medium, and the high-priced gear, and what you can do to make things as reliable as they need to be, whether even if that's, you know, 6 or even 7 9s of reliability.
Yes, sir. And the funny part is today is, you know, you could have the most expensive gear in the world, and it's actually only as good as, you know, how well it's engineered. So just like you engineers know, you know, when you're building out a new tower site or a new studio, there's a lot of planning involved, and that goes hand in hand with this, whether you're using the cheap gear or the expensive gear. So the planning is the key to everything on your reliability.
So, okay, the Skype system that you're using to talk to us on, I don't think we've ever had the pleasure of having a guest on that had a real conferencing Skype system. Give us a little bit of insight as to what you're using there.
Well, this is actually – so Double Radius, we actually have two companies. Double Radius is the equipment supplier, engineering firm, and then we also own another company called Enviacom, and I'm sitting in the Enviacom conference room right now. Enviacom is a full management system. We have over 6,000 wireless WLAN or Wi-Fi devices over the country that we own, maintain, and manage here. Basically, anywhere you go and get your Wi-Fi, there's a possibility it could be coming from us.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So you guys have some experience with this, and I take it you have plenty of broadcast operations that are very successful and happily using systems that you've engineered or sold to them or set up or any of those things.
Yeah, it actually started, I think it was back in 08, we did our first broadcast deal, and a buddy of mine, his dad is actually a radio engineer, and I was having Christmas dinner with them, and he said, "What do you do exactly?" And I told him, and he goes, "Why are you not doing that for broadcast?" And it just happened to be that the NAB radio show was in Charlotte that year, and we gave it a go and kind of see where the market was, and we did a few deals. Kind of decided that the market wasn't exactly ready for IP just yet. But then in 2010, 2011, the FCC made some rule changes, and it opened the door for us to come in and start educating.
You know, that's a good point. I want to bring Chris Tobin in on this because Chris is very familiar with some of the rules, especially for publicly traded companies. The FCC, between the FCC and Chris, I'm not remembering the two senators who passed some financial rules some time ago. Maybe you could. Yeah, maybe that was it, or maybe something else. Anyway, the rules that hey, your pipeline to making money needed to be either encrypted or secure in some way, and or otherwise inaccessible to getting perturbed. And it seems like there were plenty of engineers across the country with publicly traded companies who said, "I can't use an IP link as my STL because of such rules for publicly traded companies. I'm scratching my head. Okay. And then there were FCC rules about just which frequency bands could be used as your STL. And those rules were made back in the day when there weren't IP radios. And there was not much in terms of microwave. So those rules, I guess, had to get changed. Chris, did you come across any of that pushback?
Oh, yeah. Not pushback, but we had a lot of stuff that was switching over. And I think it was at part 101, if I got that right. Yep. And there's a couple other parts, FCC rules of regs, CFR, that, nowadays you can do any, encryption is easy. It's by default. Well, I'll take that back. It's not by default on some links. I've used redline radios and you have to turn it on. But yes, nowadays everyone's doing IP more for convenience. I mean, I'm not sure if the mandate, I gotta look back now. It's been a while. That would be the technical section 401 or 403 in the Dodd-Frank that would require, making sure that your revenue stream or everything is, not impenetrable, but at least kept out of harm's way.
Yeah.
Because even your T1s technically are not encrypted, but they're digitized. And if you could tap into it. So if you have T1s with your Interplex shelves or T1s with Mosley stuff, you could. It's not that easily. The only way you could probably follow if you want to be totally robust and bulletproof is to be FIPS 120 compliant. I think it is, or one of the FIPS 120 dot something.
Wow, so much to think about, and hey, I just try to get the audio there. And so, Jeff. Anyway, some rules changed in around 2010, made it more palatable for stations to to go ahead and do this. I think I might have been doing stuff like this anyway, but anyway. So that opened the floodgates. Jeff, kind of carry us through this adoption process. How did stations begin using IP radios?
Well, it all began with the 5.8, which was an unlicensed frequency, and the FCC really didn't change anything there. But I think it was late 2011, 2012, they opened up the Part 101 last link rule, which before that stated that a broadcaster could not use Part 101 license for the last link to the transmitter site. So when they opened that, it freed up the 6 gigahertz band, the 11 gigahertz band, and the 18 gigahertz band. Predominantly, broadcast is going to use 6 and 11. You can do 11 gig down 2 miles, 2 to 10, 2 to 8, depending on where you're at in the U.S. 6 gig is really the one that we focus on because most of the STLs are 15, 20, 30 miles long. And 6 gig gives us the ability and the power. We don't have the rain fade in that frequency. So that's kind of what we see mostly is 6 gig.
Okay. So that's good to know. Rain fade really doesn't affect 6 gig. And that's a licensed area, whereas 5.8 area is unlicensed, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah. 5.8 is a great band if you're doing something for a backup, if you're doing it just for IP traffic or maybe your remote control traffic, if you're bringing your BERC data back, it's great for those things. If you're using it for your primary STL, we ask people to tread lightly. Do they work? Yes. The issue is that most of those radios are power over Ethernet, and Ethernet transmits data at 100 megahertz. Well, let's take an FM broadcaster 99.7 frequency. That's awfully close to 100 megahertz. So your radio would act like it's working fine, but it looks like it's broken because the data never gets to the radio. And that's why it's really the Ethernet is where we have to be careful with, not so much the radios. On the radios, we have interference.
Gotcha. And let's back up a little bit. I'm familiar with using IP radios, but well, directly I'm familiar using them with an uncompressed audio protocol, Livewire, because my station's already had that. It was convenient. If the radios would carry it, I didn't have to go buy any codecs. But I would imagine that a lot of stations, especially in the early days here, they were putting coded audio, something bitrate reduced, using something from Telos or something from Comrex or APT, coding that audio to get it to a more comfortable bitrate and a more comfortable buffering. And if there's a packet loss, it could be resent if the codecs were set up that way. So you had a little bit more headroom there. Are you familiar with what stations are putting in and out of their radios in terms of coded or linear audio?
Yeah, we've worked with both. I always try to push the linear audio performs better on a licensed link, just because licensed links act more like TDM traffic, where it's packet for packet. It's a timed sync device. It's full duplex. It's if you have 100 megs out, you have 100 megs back, and it's fully timed. In the unlicensed world, everything is TDD, so it's a shared signal. You can make it look more TDD, but it's still not packet for packet. So it's sometimes it's hard to hold that clock timing when you're trying to do linear audio. But on the coded audio, unlicensed or licensed will push that without a problem.
You know, you said something in our conversation earlier, and we kind of alluded to it just now. So my experience has all been with the cheaper radios, the Ubiquiti radios, and those are glorified Wi-Fi. I mean, they're Wi-Fi engines, they're Wi-Fi protocols with a parabolic dish around the antenna, and so you get point to point and lots of apparent forward power and lots of receive sensitivity. But I'm gathering from what you're saying that the licensed radios aren't necessarily a Wi-Fi protocol. They may be proprietary, or maybe there's some other standard that you're using there that makes them not Wi-Fi, but actually more appropriate for timed, clocked, synced data transmission.
That's correct. Well, it kind of goes hand in hand with the FCC. The FCC has their Part 101 rules, and to have a radio inside those rules, they are full duplex deployments. The unlicensed radios will carry coded audio. It's just when they jump modulation scheme, most of the time they change speeds, and you get blips occasionally in those. But the licensed radios just perform better. You put them in, they're like your 950. You're buying a license, it's your frequency. You put them up and you forget about it. And in 10 years, maybe you come back and you replace it with something bigger. That's just what we've seen so far. It's been a bigger driver on the license side than the unlicensed side.
Well, I want to talk about the licensing process in just a little bit. There's some other questions that I'd like to ask you. Hey, Chris, as usual, please feel free to jump. Well, here you turn your mic on. Jump in whenever you want.
Everything Jeff said is right. He's spot on.
And so, Jeff, you've heard my story about two very rural, small-town Mississippi unlicensed links using Ubiquiti radios and setting them actually so they don't do that for any kind of modulation change. They are fixed. They are fixed at the most robust modulation scheme that gave me enough bandwidth, basically. I didn't want them jumping from 256 QAM to 16 QAM to 64 QAM. I think they're both running a QPSK at a reasonable bandwidth of 20 megahertz and are fixed. So I didn't want them jumping around. And I don't need the max bandwidth. I need them to work for my purpose. Now, compare that situation where it's rural Mississippi, not much chance for interference. Compare that with, let's say I come to Double Radius and I say, hey, I've got a medium-sized town situation. I'm in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, which is they got a university. They've got a small airport. The city's building up. And maybe even I'm in Nashville, Tennessee. What kind of radios and frequencies are you going to be steering me toward? What are you going to ask me to find out how to recommend this?
Well, before we go into that, let me say one thing. The thing is, the Ubiquiti radios work awesome. I mean, they do what they're supposed to do, and you're actually configuring them properly. When we sell a radio, everybody sees the spec sheet and they say, oh, this will do 450 megs. Oh, this will do. And they put them at full speed, full channels. And what they don't realize is that there are 7,000 internet service providers in the country, primarily in rural America, not urban America. And they're utilizing these 5 gig frequencies to connect houses via internet. So when you buy these radios, it's a lot smarter for you to put them at the lowest modulation scheme or put them at a smaller channel, clean up the airwaves some, and you have less likely to hit that interference that's going to take you down. So you're actually doing exactly, when it comes to using the Ubiquiti radios, you're doing exactly what I would recommend anybody doing, is put them on a smaller channel. And if you only need 10 megabits, set it for a 20 meg speed, even if that's a 5 megahertz channel, do that instead of setting a 40 megahertz channel. You're less likely to see the interference.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Now, so I come to you, and I'm from a larger town. What kind of questions do I need to be ready to answer to you for you to help me out the most?
Well, the number one question that has to be answered is what is your throughput requirement? And everybody says, I want to go as fast as I can. Well, that's not really a throughput requirement. So it's how many channels are you running? Are you running, you know, coded or linear? What is your throughput requirement? Are you going to be doing voice over IP? Are you going to be setting up video security at the transmitter site? Are you going to be, you know, what are the other things you're going to use this for? And then what we do is we see if we can pull that off with a low-costing radio, if that's what budget approves, or we sit there and look and see if this is something that we should push to a license link, something a more peace of mind, where, you know, I like to sleep at night, and I know the engineers, I hope they do too. You put up a license link, you sleep well at night. I mean, we can't affect light, or we can't really take care of lightning, but your interference issues are gone, and you just rock and roll. So it's really the usage is what I need to know to put the right system together.
Ah, okay. So if I told you that, okay, on one of my links from Greenville, Mississippi, to our transmitter site in a little wide spot in the road called Heads, Mississippi, on my unlicensed 5.8 Ubiquiti, it's an Air Fiber 5, so it's, you know, supposed to be able to do a gigabit. I have it set up for 50 megabits in each direction, and I'm using 10 megabits of that 50 for my live wire. Seems to me I've got 40 megabits left over for, you know, adding a voice over IP phone, which is 100 kilobits. And maybe a security camera down the road, that might be 1 megabit per second in each, you know, I mean, in the direction toward the studio. Does that sound kind of reasonable?
Yeah, you're spot on that. I mean, that the Air Fiber 5 is a great radio. It definitely creates more of a full duplex kind of design out of an unlicensed scenario. So, I mean, what you're doing, I don't know how far your link is, but what you're doing, it sounds, you know, spot on for an unlicensed deployment.
Now, it's 13 miles, and the one problem, well, actually, we've had two problems with it cutting out. One problem I'm convinced is layered atmospherics, and here's why. Mm-hmm. It has lost signal typically in the morning between 4 a.m. and sunrise. It almost never happens after local sunrise. And it's 13 miles mostly over bean fields and rice paddies. So it's going over moist soil or water. And and it only happens under the following weather conditions. It rained the day or two before. We had clear skies overnight. Not necessarily any fog, although the conditions are right for fog, but we don't necessarily get it. But I'm convinced that we're getting layering of moisture in the lower level of the atmosphere, and the microwave is just bending away somewhere.
Well, what you're seeing there is either the dew or the rain on the ground, and it's actually creating a reflection or refraction.
Oh, well, yes, rain. That could be, yeah. You could have multipath. Yeah. Okay,
so what you do in that scenario is you can test this. It works. Mm-hmm. You know, it works sometimes. It doesn't work all the time. But if you take your radios and tilt them up a degree or two.
Yeah.
You might lose a little signal strength, but just tilting it up a degree or two can eliminate that reflection that you're getting off the ground.
What an idea. Okay. Well, next time I'm up the towers, which will probably be maybe this summer, which is when it doesn't happen in the winter, not at all. Only you know, if the weather's cold, never happens. So that makes sense that I'm actually not getting refraction, but getting multipath off some water or moisture on the ground. And there are rice paddies, which...
Yeah, and it usually happens on your flat grounds like that.
Yeah, and it's flat. I mean, that part of Mississippi, you can go for miles and the elevation changes 1 inch.
There you go.
So, yeah, it's pretty flat. Okay, well, that makes sense. Now, I got to tell you, the other problem that we've had, and... We've observed it once. We didn't really see it happen this fall, but we had 3 or 4 days in a row where it cut out at the same time each day. We scratched our heads. What is this? It turned out to be sun fade. Because if you're at the studio looking at the transmitter site, the sun comes up directly behind the tower for 3 days each month. Now, the weird thing is we didn't we noticed it happened last spring. We didn't notice that it happened this fall. But have you ever heard of sun fade on a terrestrial link?
It, depending on the direction of the path, yes. I mean, I've heard of it. I've never witnessed it. So, that you know, I've heard – here's part two, hearing it again. So I have heard of it, but I haven't seen it.
Chris, you have some beautiful sunrises there in New York City as the sun comes up over the Atlantic Ocean, beaming, you know, lighting up first the tops of the tall buildings.
Oh,
I bet that
yes.
looks glorious someday. You ever heard of terrestrial sun fade?
I have talked to folks who have told me they've experienced it. They've worked on projects that have had it. I have not personally experienced it, but I'll tell you, working on top of some of the buildings at Sunrise, Empire, World Trade, and the others, I could see that happening because there have been times when we've been working on links, and as the sun's coming up across the skyline, for a moment, it just hits us on the building and then moves on, and I'm like, wow, that's pretty wild. So, yeah, I don't see why not. I mean, it's similar to what the sun does with the satellite dishes, with downlinks. When the sun gets behind the satellite, you know. So why not come off the horizon? It's a nice, very wide noise generator, that sun.
All right, so Jeff and Chris, we're going to continue the conversation in just a minute. We're going to break for commercial first. When we come back, I want to hear about a couple of things. Some of the we'll tell you what. First, we'll talk about the licensing process because to me that's a little bit scary. Jeff, earlier today you told me, Kirk, it ain't scary at all. Let me walk you through it. And so we'll talk about that because I am interested eventually in getting licensed links for my radio stations. Then I want to talk about, you know, what are the benefits and trade-offs. Like, am I better off with maybe two of the really inexpensive IP radios versus spending a lot more money for one? You know, which is better to have we'll get to what may be best and what may not be best here in just a few minutes. So Jeff's got the experience with that. You are listening to This Week in Radio Tech. It's episode 331 with Kirk Harnack, Chris Tobin, and Jeff Holdenridge. Jeff is the sales engineer for Double Radius, and they've been helping broadcasters for quite a few years in designing IP radio systems. Our show is brought to you in part by the folks at Lavo. You know, most of you know me, Kirk, as a broadcast engineer, an on-air guy, and the host of this show. But what you may not know is that I've also sold broadcast equipment all around the world. That job took me to a lot of places, to Singapore, to China several times, India, South Africa, all over Europe, Canada. Down in Colombia, Argentina, you get the idea, all over the place. And I've seen broadcasters do a lot of different things in pretty imaginative ways. That's one of the reasons I'm excited to introduce you to our sponsor, Lavo. That's Lavo.com. Now, Lavo's famous around the world for television, audio, and video, especially for high-profile event coverage like the Olympics, World Cup Soccer, the Grammy Awards. When the broadcast is mission critical, you're likely to find a Lavo audio console there. Now, you wouldn't believe how this stuff is built. It's really over-engineered, lots of redundancies. Sometimes the backups have backups because there's really no do-overs in live event broadcasting. And dead air, well, that'll kill your career. Now, you might be thinking, why should I care? I'm not doing TV. I'm a radio guy. Well, you know, radio guys hate dead air even more than TV guys because air is all we have. So broadcasters like NPR, CBC, the BBC, to name a few, have bought Lavo radio consoles. Now, being this involved in TV and radio around the world means that Lavo thinks a lot about the future, too. And everyone knows that all types of media are converging on a common IP delivery platform. Well, Lavo's ready for it with broadcast gear that can handle audio, video, and control of every studio device using a single integrated computer network. Off-the-shelf stuff. And after that, well, virtualization is coming and broadcasting from the cloud. Lavo is building those tools right now. So if absolute bulletproof reliability and five nines of uptime and being future-proof are important to you, check out Lavo. Go to the website and go to the special link, if you would, please, for TWRT listeners. It's Lavo, Lavo.com/TWRT, Lavo.com/TWIRT to find out more. And that way they'll know that, hey, it was us who told you about it. That's always important. Hey, you're in that business, in the radio business. You tell people all the time, hey, come in and mention our ad for a big discount. Thanks, Slavo, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, we're talking to Jeff Holdenridge. Chris and I are here. Chris is in a transmitter location somewhere in near Times Square. By the way, Chris, I was reading some hotel reviews. Actually, I was reading an article about New York and how they've passed laws that really prevent Airbnb from operating there, and how despite that law, something like 52,000 Airbnb rooms were rented. I forget if it was over the holidays or over the last year or whatever, maybe since the law went into effect. And the article pointed out that there's a hotel in New York City, and of course it's not Airbnb, it's a regular hotel, and it is the worst hotel in the country. is there one called Hotel Carter in the Times Square area?
There could be. There's a lot of activity here in Times Square.
Yeah.
It wouldn't surprise me if there's a place. The turnover is unbelievable. And, you know, it's New York City. We find ways to just work around the obstacles. I'll put it like that. You know, so.
Well, I have stayed in some fabulous hotels in New York, and I've stayed in a couple of dives as well. And I've never stayed at this, I believe it's called Hotel Carter. And I've never stayed in that one. It's never popped up on, you know, Kayak or Expedia or anything like that, or even Hotwire. So I've never looked into that one. But this article says this is consistently the worst hotel in America.
Oh, it's probably has some great rates. It's, you know, you come in, you go, whatever. I mean, when you're here in the city, it's a holiday, especially.
Yeah.
All you need is a place to crash. Who cares how it looks, what it's like?
Yeah.
It's a roof over your head for the time you're here. That's how people look at it. If it's in the area, I'll look for it. I'll look it up. I'll look up the address, and I'll take a walk over.
I might send you the article that I was reading. Okay, Chris, before we accidentally skip by, is there anything else you want to tell us about the room that you're in? It's a backup transmitter site for an FM station.
It's just a backup site. Actually, the whining you hear in the background, I think one of the cooling fans are going. It just started. It wasn't there before. It's just the site. It operates from here. Its signal is equivalent to the main. It does very well. And the one thing about this location for broadcasters who are familiar with it, the Durst organization that manages it, it's done a very nice job of making sure that all facilities cater to those who are in the telecom communications business. So for broadcasters, we've got a lot of redundancy in the building. A lot of redundancy for access to the rooftop, to the basement for telecom purposes, power utilities. So it's a nice site. It's a nice setup. And the line of work that Jeff is in, a lot of those folks are here. I'm sure they've probably done work on this building. And as a matter of fact, just this morning I walked past somebody putting in some more changing out radios at 11 gigs up top. So, yeah, it's a busy place, but it's a good site.
You know, on a roof like where you're at, and I've had the pleasure of being on that roof once. In fact, they were filming exterior shots for Spider-Man 3 the day that we were up there on a tour. And, you know, I was just so overwhelmed by everything I was seeing. I didn't get to really look for what I'm going to ask you about, and that is, what variety of IP radios do you see? And by that, what I mean is, do you see radios that have Ethernet going to them, and then the radio and everything is all in one? Or do you see a lot more of the split type of technology where part of it's, you know, you have an indoor unit and an outdoor unit? Or do you have any that are fully indoors, except there's waveguide, you know, that rectangular waveguide going all the way up to the antenna out there? What do you see there on the roof?
To answer your question, yes. There is everything. There are ODUs and IDU packages. There are indoor-outdoor units. There are units that the Ethernet goes directly to the back of the radio and dish and antenna all in one piece. That's using outdoor Cat5 cable. Let's not assume it's the stuff you use in your studios. It's reinforced stuff. And there's actually, I will be installing in a couple of weeks on a weekend, replacing a radio link using a 7/8 line that'll work at 5 gig, not 7/8 inch and 5 gigs. We'll be actually, the transmitter will be downstairs and the antenna is going to be up top, so it's gonna be fun to try that one out just for giggles. But yes, every combination. I mean, license links, unlicensed links, flat panel or pizza box antennas, as I like to call them. There are the dual type duplex. There's a lot of duplex up top. There's a couple of companies that are doing many, many miles hop connections between their POPs, points of presence, this is one of the hubs. So it's fascinating, the stuff that's up there. I've been up on a couple of the parapets, and you walk around and just take a look, see, you're like, okay, look at that. Oh, look, what frequency is that one at? You know, there was a dish up there. Somebody's experimenting. I think, I could be wrong, it was 60 gigs or 80 gigs. I think it's one of those, I'll call it the 5G Internet of Things testing, but I looked at it. I was like, you know, it's a little guy. It's this little guy. Well, wow, that's got to be really high up there. And one of the techs was talking, and you know, he wouldn't say yes or no, but just sort of gave that look of when I asked the question that the answer could be yes or no, and just looked at me. So I'm assuming that he must have worked with a group of people that just those letters you don't talk about. So, I've worked on a couple of rooftops recently where I've bumped into folks like that, and they look at you like, "Who are you? What are you doing here?" I'm like, "I'm not like you. I'm working on a radio link. Mine just happens to be a little more public than yours."
But, by the way,
yes.
Go ahead.
I was just saying, I was on the Citicorp building recently doing some work, and we bumped into a few of those folks that just looked at us like, "Really? Why are you here?" I'm like, "Well, your cage of gear is there, and then the cage. My gear is here without a cage, and there's a reason for that. So we're cool. Don't worry. I'm not peeking or taking pictures. You know, we're fine." But they were just putting up a new link. It was AT&T was doing some linking.
If you were peeking or taking pictures, I think security might have stopped you earlier in the process of getting to the roof.
Well, yeah. They definitely, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's the part that makes me laugh when I'm in some of these locations. I have all these badges, you know. I do have stinking badges. And access is not easy. So, you know, when you're up in a place where access requires short of biometrics and everything else, you sort of look at the other guy and go, "Dude, if I'm up here and you're up here, obviously we went through the same checkpoint. Don't panic." You know, it's like, but it's entertaining sometimes. And there have been locations where, you know, I've been asked to sort of leave while they do their work. I'm like, okay. And I have to call up the people I'm working with and go, "Guys, that TV shot, the video you want, I can't give it to you right now." Why? There's a guy here with a sidearm that says basically I need to leave the room. Right? That's happened a couple of times. Yeah.
That, you know, that,
well, you know, if you're,
that
work, you're working in Washington, that happens on a regular basis.
Yeah.
That's why I've had that happen.
That just doesn't happen to most of us broadcast engineers.
It depends on where you work. You know, there's a few guys I've worked with at Empire that we've had that run in. It's not uncommon. It's just, it happens.
Well, speaking of the law, let's move on to licensing. Jeff Holden-Ridd from Double Radius is here with us, and Jeff, I appreciate what you've told us so far. Let's talk about this licensing thing, because it's a big, scary thing for me. And you said, no. Because I'm used to licensing radio stations, which takes years and forms and thousands of dollars every year to keep the license alive. And it's just it's a big, hairy deal. You got to get an attorney to help you out. What's licensing microwaves like?
So it's actually it's pretty simple. You know, basically what you're doing is you're filling out some paperwork. Well, this also depends on if you work with us or if you work with somebody else. We do every bit of it from PCN to FCC filing, or if you have somebody, a legal team that you work with, we can do the prior coordination notice and your team can do the filing. But basically what it comes down to is you fill out a little bit of paperwork and you file a PCN, which is a prior coordination notice. Now, if you do it expedited, it goes in 2 weeks. If you don't, it's approximately 4 to 6 weeks. Once the PCN comes back clear, and all the PCN is just notifying all the people in the area that have licenses in those frequencies that, hey, you're going to put something up, and it gives them a chance to kind of say, well, this might cause interference. Let me do some checking on it. Once the PCN is clear, you are able to file the license with the FCC. As long as you're not within 10 miles of a U.S. border, meaning Canada or Mexico, or there's a couple other locations, just spotty locations, you're able to operate that day. So you can operate your gear in as little, if you have it on the shelf ready to go, you can operate in as little as 2 weeks. We usually tell everybody 4 just to be safe. But that's really the simple licensing process. It's a little bit of paperwork, and then you file with the FCC.
Now, okay, but before you file the PCN, who is it or what kind of entity helps you determine the frequency you're going to apply for on your link?
So there's companies out there. I'm sure you guys are familiar with some of them. You know, there's companies like Micronet, ComSearch, IntelliPath, just to name a few. Those are companies that what you do is when you submit the paperwork that we're filling out, they find a channel for you that's available, or multiple channels if you're trying to run dual polarity, multiple gig links, and they put all that together and send out the PCN for you.
Okay. All right. And then who is it that gets notified? I mean, you said it goes to the licensees, but I mean, do the licensees actually look at the PCN notifications that come out from the FCC, or do you typically have a Washington attorney that's paid to look out for these kind of things?
Whoever's filed on the license, so if I have a license and I'm within, I think it's a 100-mile or 50-mile radius of you, and you're filing for one, I'm going to get a letter that says, hey, you know, Kirk is filing for a license. Here's his frequencies. Here's his, you know, all his math. Here's where we're showing it's not going to interfere with what you're doing. And then I have a choice. I can research it more and report back, or I can just throw it away. And that's basically my response, is I'm not responding. And, you know, 95 out of 100 times we don't see a response, to be honest with you.
Have you seen any applications and any PCNs that, well, this is dumb. This is obviously going to interfere with somebody. I hope they catch it, or, you know, we'll help. We'll catch it for them, or whatever. Do you see some that just don't make good engineering sense?
No, the people that are coordinating these licenses are under FCC rule. Like, they're doing a database that's actually put together with the FCC and the rules. So they see the warning reports based on how much that could interfere or not, and there's a threshold that the FCC sets on that. So you really don't see people sending out letters of, like, this is going to be a problem. Really, the only time you run into issues, like if you're down in the Houston, San Antonio area, you have earth stations, those cause problems for lower 6 gig. But, you know, we have backup. We can go to upper 6 gig. We can't get a channel as big. We can't get as much throughput, but it'll still do the job that usually what we're trying to do here.
Okay. So once that what are the filing costs typically for the coordination and then filing the PCN and finally the license?
The FCC increased their fee this year, which wasn't much. But to give you an idea, roughly $2,200 to $2,500 covers your PCN and FCC filing with us. And that also depends on how many links, because your PCN is a fee per link and the FCC files per site. So if you're running like an A to B, B to C, you have two PCNs and three FCC filings. So it just depends on how the whole system is set up.
Okay. All right. And then are there recurring renewal fees for the licenses, or are they good until you quit?
So the fees that we charge, they come with a one-year protection plan. And if you want to continue the protection after that, that's where we get the PCNs for the links around you, and we reply back on your behalf. Other than that, no, there's no the renewal fee is a 10-year license. So your renewal is in 10 years, and you have the first right of refusal on your renewal.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, that helps. All right. So have you alluded to some areas where you don't have the entire 6 gig band available to you because of earth stations, for example. I guess there's that radio quiet zone somewhere in West Virginia. I'll bet we probably don't do much around that area.
We've actually put wireless links in the quiet zone. You just have to have approval before it ever happens.
Yeah. Okay.
And I believe it's forestry or something like that that has to approve that. Yeah.
Oh. Okay. Okay. Interesting. And if you are a licensed, you have a licensed link. Are there people that occasionally will experience interference because somebody went on the air without a license?
I've seen that once in my 15 years where somebody illegally was operating a licensed radio. I'm sure it happens, but we don't see it very often, because when you get in the licensed world, depending on your antenna size, you're talking about a 1.5 to 3 degree beam width on your antenna. So it's kind of, unless you're directly behind it or directly in front of it, you're not going to see that interference, you know, when you're talking about a 90 degree off axis and things like that.
That is one of the huge benefits. And I guess the beam widths are really even better than, say, 950 megahertz STLs, which have caused interference to each other, even when you think maybe they shouldn't, because there's still signal out there available, even if it's outside of the main lobes. An interesting case in point in that comes, I hope I didn't tell the story before, and I'll make it really brief. I had a couple of 950 megahertz STL antennas, and they were knockoffs of your typical Scala or Cathrine 950 antennas. And on the same 13-mile path as the IP radios I've been discussing. And the signal strength at the receiver was never all that great. In fact, the previous engineer had put an amplifier there from Advanced Receiver Research to boost it up and make it usable. Well, I got playing around and ended up through a comedy of errors, realized that these two antennas at 950 weren't even pointed at each other. Neither one was pointed toward the other. They were both off axis by something like 15 to 20 degrees, and yet it worked. So it was basically from one dipole to another dipole 13 miles away. They were off that much. And of course, we corrected that, got them back pointed at each other, locked them down, and lo and behold, we didn't need the amplifier anymore. That was great. But it points out that 950 megahertz has a fair amount of possibility for interfering well off axis. But you're saying that 6 gigahertz, there's not much off axis at all there, is there?
No, I mean, when you look at 950, your Fresnel zone or Fresnel zone, some people call it, you know, that's 100 feet plus. You know, the oval that carries that wavelength. In 5.8, it's approximately, just guesstimating, between 20 and 30 feet. So you're not talking about a huge area to cover for side access.
Gotcha. Hey, you brought up something. Let's talk about Fresnel zone for a moment. I saw a really good, and you may have seen it too, Jeremy Ruck at the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association gave a talk about designing reliability into microwave paths. And he went into a fair amount of math. It was over my head. But Jeremy's a good guy. Seems to know what he's talking about. But he did talk a lot about Fresnel zones. And whenever I've done a study like with Ubiquiti's online tool that uses Google Earth, it shows you, you know, your Fresnel zone clearance. Talk to us a little bit about that, why it's so critical, and what are some of the easy mistakes to make with regard to Fresnel zone clearance?
Well, the biggest thing is if you are standing at point A and looking at point B, just because you see it doesn't mean you have line of sight. You have to clear the Fresnel zone 100% to have line of sight. So if I'm on a roof and there's a tree next to me, and we're, you know, the tree's a little higher than the roof, but the link's shooting just over it, you might have Fresnel zone infraction there, and then you're more of a near line of sight. So when you're in the unlicensed world of 5.8, some of these radios might do 20, 30 miles without a problem line of sight. But as soon as you impact that Fresnel zone, it might drop it down to like 6 or 8 to make it reliable.
And
the
for
same
those
thing with the licensed world, we have to – we have to prove to the FCC that we have 100% line of sight, or we will never get – it's kind of like a gentleman's law kind of thing. You have to do it to get approval.
And we certainly have some listeners and viewers who are not familiar with this concept. The Fresnel zone is this imaginary space that kind of looks like a football or like a cigar that's tight on both ends and then fat in the middle. And it's this imaginary volume of space between – two microwave antennas, that this space must be clear. It can't be infringed upon. And it's the space is biggest in the middle. So if there's a hill in the middle of your path, you have to worry about Fresnel zone clearance. You have to go up perhaps higher at one end or the other or both, so that this cigar-shaped volume clears any obstacle, trees or hills or buildings or water towers, that kind of stuff.
Wow. And the Ubiquiti tool is very good to help figure that out. Another tool, Cambium Networks has what's called Link Planner. You can Google it, you know, Cambium Networks Link Planner. It's a free tool. You can actually add trees to the path calc and, you know, you can verify, you know, if I say I'm in West Virginia, I'm going to put in a 100-foot tree just to be safe. And that way you can check to see where your Fresnel zone is at different frequencies.
So for 5.8 and 6 gig, Fresnel zone is probably pretty similar. But what about 11 gigs? Is that a fatter or a skinnier Fresnel zone?
It's going to be skinnier as you go up in frequency.
Okay. You know, at 950, we were also worried about our Fresnel zone, but we could also get by with, I believe typically we could say, well, if you've got at least 0.6 Fresnel zone clearance, then you're okay at 950. Chris, does that ring a bell with you and these kind of calculations?
Yep. Oh, yeah. I installed a link some time ago. I think they were Saragons. And we were putting them up. And one of the guys we were working with, the company we worked with, I asked and someone else asked because I do a lot of the RF. And I was like, anybody check the Fresnel zones and make sure? Because you're mounting this pole on the side of the building. And I'm looking, and it's like part of the building is sort of parallel with the dish. And the guy's like, oh, no, don't worry about it. You're at, were we 11 gig? I forget what, I think it was 11 gig. And he's like, no, we'll be fine. And I'm going, alrighty. So I quickly went and did one of those link studies, you know, those free tools. And it worked. Thank goodness we were only shooting, trying to connect between, I think, a mile and a half from where we were on top of the building here in the city, down. So we had the height and looking down. It worked. But you looked at the spectrum on the radio and you could see it. All you had to do is turn the dish a little bit, you can see a change, and you're like, "Yeah, okay. I think we need to rethink this mount. We'll put it in place, but we're gonna have to come back and move it farther away or off to the edge of the rooftop." But yeah, you can run into that and not even realize it. Yeah, 950 at 460. Some of the land mobile stuff I've worked with Yagis. I happen to have one here. This is a cellular Yagi. Look at that. Huh? How about that? Or you could say it's a shark fin. There we go. So, yeah, you know, you're looking straight down the pipe here, and you'd be surprised how you can interfere with stuff around the edges. And, Fresnel understanding is important. There's a lot of things in RF you got to understand, and Jeff's right. I mean, you can't ever be too certain. You got to double-check everything.
Hey, it totally occurred to me. We haven't looked at any of the pictures yet, and I failed to ask our producer, Suncast, if we could bring any of those pictures up. Suncast, can you give us a yes or no, or go ahead and pop a picture up from the link that I sent you earlier.
Hey, we got all of them at once.
All at once. Can we zoom in on the first one, maybe? Yes. Okay. What are we looking at here, Jeff?
This picture here is just a standard PoE installation, rather it's licensed or unlicensed. But I wanted to show this because of the layout. If you look at the Cat5 cable, that's where you get interference from your FM broadcast. And that's the one thing that you might have a radio in place and it's not working. It actually is. It's that cable. So I highly recommend that there's a cable out there called Superior Essex. They make it's a BBDGE. It's a copper clad cable that actually helps. So if you have to run Ethernet, I highly recommend that you look at that cable there because it does a really good job of bleeding out interference. And because it has a solid copper shield, you can ground it very easily. So if you have to ground it every 25, 50 feet, you can do that. So that's the first picture there.
Sure. Let's move on to the next one then quickly because I didn't realize how much we were out of time. That's okay. All right. What's this?
So this one here is this is something Ubiquiti made. For those of you using Ubiquiti radios, this box here allows you to run DC power up the tower, run fiber up the tower, and then just have like a small little 1-foot Ethernet PoE directly to the radio. So it eliminates that Ethernet we're talking about getting the interference, because at that little, you know, 1 foot or 3 foot jumper that you put in, with all the grounding you're putting in on the FPOE or the radio, it's not going to get interference in that short cable. So this is a great alternative to where you can run fiber up the tower, run DC power up the tower, and you can power your device PoE directly off of that. So this is a
really
neat little device.
Yep.
Just want to introduce to people.
Cool. That really reduces lightning's possible path. Cool. Mm-hmm. What's next?
Yeah. So the next one is an actual power box that they created, and this is a way that you can have redundant DC or AC power supply on the ground and run fiber up the tower, basically to the device we just showed, or also to the little white box in the middle of the tower. That's the edge point. You can do it to 8 or 16. So if you have a tower with a lot of radios, you can end up running a single fiber up, run the power up, and it has an 8 or 16 port switch inside of it that can run PoE to each one of your radios. So it's cool little device to run fiber in DC. This is just to get Ethernet off the tower, which seems to be the primary problem in FM.
Yeah, this is good innovative solutions to problems that we are all worried about. I'm worried about it at my stations. I've got a fiber patch at the bottom of the tower, but that still doesn't change the fact that I've got this long conductor running up the side of the tower to the radio. What's next?
And Ethernet spikes on Lightning a lot faster than anything else. So we're talking license. For those of you that love your Ubiquiti radios, we think they're great, but they've just released their 11FX. This is a Part 101 licensed 11 gigahertz air fiber. So this is 11 gigahertz. Depending on where you are in the U.S. is where I would decide how far you're going to go. If you're in the southeast, it's going to be a shorter distance than the north or the northwest or the west just because of rain fade.
Yeah. There's rain does affect that frequency. Was that all our pictures, or is there another?
There's a couple more we can run through real quick. This is another option that we offer for those of you that want a 6 gig solution. What's great about this radio here, it's made by Cambium or Saragon. It allows you to DC power and run fiber directly in, or you can go PoE. So this is an all outdoor solution, but it allows you to do DC and fiber.
Nice. All right. And one more picture. What's this?
SAF is another manufacturer that we work with. I like them because they're a split system. So if you want to run Heliax up the tower, we can run half inch up the tower from the indoor unit to the outdoor unit. They also have expansion boxes that we can do 16 T1s or 4 ASIs. So if you're a TV and you want to do ASI, we can carry that native ASI across this link, and we have for a lot of the TV broadcasters. It's a great little split system.
Cool. Very nice. And so that's all the pictures. You had something there on the table with you. I think you wanted to play show and tell.
Yeah, actually, I do have the Air Fiber 11 here, so you can kind of take a look at the size of it. This is actually made of metal. It is not a plastic radio. It has end connectors on the top. There are three different antenna manufacturers that you can use with this. Ubiquiti released a 2.5-foot antenna, which is perfect for this. Radio waves is the one we primarily recommend because it is Category A. Category A allows the FCC to approve it. You never have to worry about interference. Category B, you could have an interference in the future and have to change it to a Category A. So that whole noise and interference is a lot better on a Category A. So I just wanted to show you this real quick, kind of give you an idea of the size.
Cool. Hey, guys, what we're going to do, we are going to take a break for a sponsor. We're going to hear from the folks at the Telos Alliance. By the way, I just got my direct current e-newsletter today, as I usually do on Thursday. It's got a whole new look. Now, the content's still good, but it's got a whole new look. Easier to read. I like it. By the way, the Telos Alliance website has just been updated as well, and we hope it's easier to navigate. I think it certainly looks prettier, and I like the way it works. So you want to check that out. Coming up, I got to warn Jeff, and Chris knows about this. He's been doing this a while. He's been here almost every episode for 331. We're going to do a little tip. So, Jeff, if you can think of a tip that you'd like to leave our listeners and viewers with, if it's a handy website, if it's just something that, you know what, here's something you really ought to know, that'll be great, too. And I've got a little funny myself. That's coming up in just a minute. Let's hear from the folks at the Telos Alliance.
Not much in the paper today, is there?
Yeah, not much. Seems tough to stay informed, you know?
Like we're missing out on stuff, important stuff.
Yeah, feels like week-old news, yesterday's stories. Half the tech stuff in here seems out of date by the time I see it.
What Kirk doesn't know is I'm way ahead of everyone else around here. Every Thursday, I get this newsletter in my email. It's direct current. The folks at the Telos Alliance publish this.
What Joe doesn't know is I keep one step ahead of the radio guys in this market. Every Thursday, I get direct current from the folks at the Telos Alliance. It's a free newsletter about radio engineering, audio, streaming, studios, everything.
Thursday afternoons, we have our department head meeting. I look like a genius, thanks to the knowledge, updates, and advice in Direct Current. Sometimes I wonder if I should tell Kirk about Direct Current. Might help him out.
I wonder if I should let Joe in on my secret. He could use a little help sometimes.
Get Direct Current in your inbox every Thursday. Read profiles of engineers and newsmakers in the broadcast community. Get technical pointers putting you and your facility at an advantage. Important industry news and views. Plus, you'll be up to date on Telos Omnia Axia and ZipStream products. It's all here in the Direct Current newsletter. Subscribe online at telosalliance.com/directcurrent. That's telosalliance.com/directcurrent.
Thanks, Telos, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, it's time for tips. And Chris Tobin, maybe you've got something to leave our listeners with.
Well, sure. Well, first, I'll show a picture in one of those diagrams. We had a PIDU. There's one. That's what it looks like in the flesh. This Motorola PTP300. Jeff's laughing, yes.
He knows what it is.
Yeah. Well, it's got a history of issues. Anyway, the tip that I want to bring I totally forgot last time was, you know how many times you go into a rack room, a transmitter site, or maybe a radio room that's got stuff in racks, and you try to take it out with a hand screwdriver, and you say, what the devil did these people think? Or you look at the screws, and they're somewhat distorted. So
yeah.
Try this. Remember this now. I'm going to show you. I'm going to put the microphone down.
Yes!
Notice
yes,
how I was able to grab the...
yes!
Adjust it first, and then put the screws in the rack. You should not do anything more than hand tight. Okay? Please. I was working at a site a couple of months back, and one of the guys I'm working with is like, we've got a problem. We had several screws that were stripped. Somebody decided to do the impact drill... the impact drill section, and it's like, really? Come on. So that's my tip. Just, practice. It's fun. Try it out.
I don't know what the real term is. I call that the clutch. It's an adjustable clutch. Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. The, and it doesn't even need to be up at 8 or 9. Put it to 5. You know,
five,
so you can stop it with your hand.
One. It works. I just used it in the racks. It works just fine.
The screw doesn't have to be manhandled into the rack.
Here's the other tip. If at number 2 you can't get the screw to go into the rack rail or into the transmitter or the chassis, stop.
Yeah.
Either the cover is misaligned or maybe the thread's already stripped. Okay, don't make it worse by impacting it and making a rivet out of it. Just saying.
And I'd like to add, that's a great tip. And that is one of my pet peeves. And one of my joys is when I have one of those drills and I set the clutch where it won't just drive the thing in like a gorilla.
Now, granted, those of you who are movie buffs will remember this scene from Uncle Buck.
The only thing I would add to that, Chris, is remember that putting screws in diagonally does no good. It's just dumb. Put them in the bottom. The top doesn't need them, maybe for weight, but...
Don't do diagonal. That twists the chassis. And if it's a computer device, microcontrollers, twisting the chassis on a motherboard, not a good idea. It really doesn't work.
I know. And if you're really, really anal retentive, you can turn all your slotted screws so that they're up and down so they won't collect dust. I don't know if that's true or not.
Yeah, okay. That's when you come up with the baseball bat and just get them out. That's it.
That's when we draw the line,
Draw the line at that. That's not it. Not happening. That's done.
All right. Jeff, have you got a tip for our listeners to leave us with?
I do. I have a tip for the IP microwave people that are looking to deploy. On the license links, every manufacturer has a BNC connector on the back of it. This is for alignment to go into a voltmeter. I'm sorry, if I knew I was doing this, I'd have had it here. But they make a shielded BNC clip to a voltmeter. And if you supply your tower crews with that, alignment will be so much easier. You will probably cut the time in half to align a link. So it has to be a shielded, BNC to voltmeter plug. But that is my tech tip for y'all today.
I think that's typically a banana plug or, two banana plugs, one for the plus and one for the minus. That's great, BNC to banana plugs. I've not seen that, but I bet you could just Google that and bam, find it right away. What a great idea. What a great idea. Hey, my tip real quickly before we have to shove out of here is we're already seeing a huge explosion in the Internet of Things, IoT, the Internet of Things, and it's only going to grow exponentially. And I'm just repeating something I heard on another podcast because it's absolutely true, and those of you with a little bit of IT security sense will totally get this. The S in IoT stands for security. Think about that. The S in IoT stands for security. But there's the... Yeah, that's right. We got a long ways to go before this world is ready for too many IoT devices. And I think it's going to be a tough road to hoe for a while. Hey, thanks so very much to Chris Tobin for being here on the show today, This Week in Radio Tech. Thanks also to Jeff Holdenrid with DoubleRadius.com. Check them out at DoubleRadius.com. They sell lots of stuff that you're going to need, so go check it out. And but more than sell it, they have lots of advice about this stuff, and they can help you out with the things that Jeff talked about, licensing and you know, watching your license, that kind of monitoring. All right, we're going to be back next week with another great edition of This Week in Radio Tech. Thanks so much to... first of all, Chris, and also to Jeff, and also to Suncast, our producer for the show. Appreciate you very much, Suncast, being here and making the show look good. And thanks also to Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network, home of lots of fine podcasts. And finally, thanks to our sponsors, Lavo at lawo.com/twert, and also to the Telus Alliance with Direct Current, telusalliance.com/directcurrent. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.